justice. Right. Unless there's something else you want to raise over lunch.
No, not just at this particular juncture.
Okay. Just in case there's a solution to priorities. No, it's okay. You can tell me that when you're ready to tell me that.
Yes, there will be a solution in terms of the date. We'll explore a little with Mr. De Pelsmaker. Some thinking, but yeah, okay. I don't have a solution to proffer just at the minute. Yeah. Right, the second element to consider in the context of scope, so we're dealing with scope for essentially new rules in the plan change. The TAs have argued that new rule 10A31A2 passes the second limb of the Clearwater test because it has been analysed in the section 32AA assessment carried out by Mr. Tews that no person would be affected by its inclusion as the full spectrum of interests are represented in the PC7 proceedings. The CWS takes are afforded a higher priority than other takes under the NPSFM. The Council maintains its position that there is a risk of other persons being affected by the additional new rule. As set out above, applications to take new water involve increased uncertainty of potential adverse effects on both water bodies and other persons, this uncertainty being the genesis of the fully discretionary activity status for new CWS takes under the operative plan. The restriction of matters proposed by the new rule that can be considered when deciding applications for new community water supplies takes that has the potential to affect the water body in question, and determination of those matters is something that other persons may have wished to participate in. The Council does not consider that the prioritisation of CWS in comparison to other water uses addresses the natural justice issues posed by the inclusion of the new rule. The second limb of the Clearwater test is focused on the ability of persons to participate in planning processes. An automatic assertion of a higher priority should not trump the participation rights of persons potentially affected by the new rule. Further, not all uses of water supplied through a community water scheme may be considered a second priority under the NPSFM. It is further submitted that the assessment of new rule 10A31A2 in the section 32AA assessment carried out by Mr. Tews does not have any bearing on the second limb of the Clearwater test. The assessment was carried out long after the period for making submissions and further submissions closed, this being the time frame within which potentially affected persons could have submitted on the new rule. At its core, Plan Change 7 aims to ensure that implementation of the LWRP to come is not undermined by an increased reliance on water. The provision of an additional rule providing for new water has the opposite effect, and accordingly the potential to affect other water users. For these reasons, the Council does not consider that new rule 10A31A2 meets either limb of the Clearwater test and accordingly submits that the new rule is not on or about the plan change.
Okay, just one matter of clarification. Paragraph 147, here you're talking about the regional water plan, and if you were to make an application for a new permit, that is has a fully discretionary activity status under that plan. Earlier in the day, you were talking about a controlled activity status. Excuse me. And so what was the controlled activity status in relation to new community water schemes? What did that pertain to?
What I had in mind was where it was a scheme listed in the schedule, but for which a new take point, perhaps from a different water body. My understanding is that that would be a controlled activity. Maybe not, says Ms. Irving.
It's probably. Do you mind if Ms. Irving can clarify the rule?
Yes, be helpful.
I double checked that, and the rule, the controlled activity rule, refers you back to the schedules in the operative plan, and those schedules specifically list a location, a take point location, which is a coordinate. And so in my view, if you're not applying for a take from that specific location, then you wouldn't fall within that controlled activity rule, in which case the discretionary activity rule would apply.
And just pause a second. So if you're not applying for a take at that location, and that's the location defined by coordinates.
Yes, in the schedule.
In the schedule, the coordinates plan. In the schedule, then you are a what?
Then it defaults to discretionary.
I know this issue came up in Stirling, didn't it?
Yes.
How was it argued in Stirling?
I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to ask Mr. Page to address that.
Well, Mr. Page wasn't counsel, but I thought it was one issue I just didn't want to deal with. Where there was a change in take, the point of take changed. Definitely the scheme remained the same, but there was a change in take location. Move from a coordinate. Might not have been very far, but there was something there.
Yes, I think that my recollection is that that was resolved between the planners is didn't require a discretionary consent as part of what you were dealing with.
I don't remember quite why. It didn't have any bearing, according to Ms. Malpop's submission on duration and the matters for consideration under duration, therefore a decision not required from the court.
Yes, so my understanding, Your Honour, was there was a change in the take location. I think we were talking about sort of 50 metres, I think,
yep.
And there was an issue with the coordinates that were listed in the schedule and the plan, because I think the way they operate, they're not necessarily true to what's happening on the ground, necessarily. And so that, by the council, dealt with that in its original decision. I think it treated it as a transfer as part of the application. But looking at the transfer provisions, the planners took the view that it was a controlled activity following the conferencing that they had, that it did meet the requirements of a controlled activity in the way that the schedule operated and the uncertainty around the coordinates.
Yeah, and is that 100 metre grid that somebody referred to yesterday? So you could be anywhere at the coordinates. Well, you could be within 100 metres of the coordinates actually given in the plan. Or is that something, a different issue altogether?
I'm not sure if it's exactly the same issue, but that was an issue then in terms of the realm in which those coordinates applied.
Yeah. Your submission, if I remember rightly, though, was that I thought your planner was actually running an argument that the court did have to look at this as if it were a new take, but that your submission was pragmatic. It didn't have a bearing on the duration.
Yes, in Mr. Bell's evidence, he did explore the issue, but then they addressed it through conferencing, and he agreed that it wasn't a new location or a transfer, and then the submission was that it wasn't relevant to duration anyway in terms of the activity status.
Okay, but ordinarily, and I don't recall what the planner said in the JWS, whether they actually gave reasons as they...
But the way the schedule works in the plan is the schemes that are listed in the schedule, and the schedule does have those coordinates.
Those coordinates, and if you were to change, move, yep, okay. So controlled, if you're wanting a new take in relation to that coordinated point, but becomes discretionary if you're actually shifting.
That would be my view, and if you were shifting from surface water to groundwater, you wouldn't fit within that controlled activity.
So you'd be
rule.
Discretionary.
That would be my understanding.
Right. Everyone happy with that?
Yep.
Okay. Alrighty. Hydro.
Oh no, I had two more things to note in relation to scope.
Yep.
And it's not in the written material, but I flagged that the analysis applies equally to the argument put forward by Fish and Game with respect to its new non-complying activity rule for all new takes. And in my submission, the prejudice argument is even stronger with respect to the Fish and Game rule than it is with the TA's rule. And that is because, in my submission, would all potential future new users of water have appreciated that Plan Change 7 was going to change the activity status for such applications to non-complying.
But, and I haven't checked, But I thought it was Fish and Game's submission that it was always there in their submission, in their original submission.
So the question is not a question of whether it was fairly and reasonably raised in the submission. It's the second limb. It's the question of whether it's on Plan Change 7. And the prejudice arises in the context of determining whether the submission is on Plan Change 7.
And on Plan Change 7, you're saying it is not on Plan Change 7 because Plan Change 7 is not seeking to introduce new rules in relation to new activities, just a policy change on duration. And then, of course, Ms. Irving has responded directly to that in terms of there being a functional relationship between the policy and subsequent rules.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And just in terms of the policy argument, my submission is you can't just read the policy in isolation from the explanatory material that sets out what Plan Change 7 is addressing.
Yep.
So that was the...
Yep.
The second matter on scope... The council had raised an issue with the submission or the position being advanced by Mr. Ensor on the part of the minister. And my friend addressed that in her closing submissions on, I'm going to say, Monday. The approach that the council had taken to raising issues of scope was one of looking only at the submission of the party themselves. We didn't go and then look for where else there might be scope for the issue. We simply flagged there was an issue on the face of the party's own submission, and if the party could then respond to say, well, there's scope within other submissions, then that's fine, but we simply shift the onus back onto them at that point. What I do take issue with in terms of Ms. Dixon's submission, though, was her submission that the carve-outs for hydro and territorial authorities did fit within the scope of the minister's submission on account of the minister seeking prohibited activity status. And taking that argument to its fullest extent, if one was to lodge a submission on a plan change saying all activities should be a prohibited activity and then turning up at a hearing and arguing for a whole range of controls or caveats for activities beneath of that, parties simply wouldn't have been put on notice that that was the case. So my submission is there's no scope within the minister's submission with respect to community water supply or hydro, but that those issues are fairly before the court through other parties' submissions. But not insofar as new activities are concerned.
Okay. So provided that some other party made a submission that is on the plan change... that's sufficient, even if the minister did not themselves.
Yes.
Yep. And that would also be true for ORUG. If ORUG is now left with a reject-only submission, but if another party sought to introduce a merits-based discretionary rule, that would be sufficient.
We've had a pretty good look at that question, and it's an interesting question. There's no authority to say that you can't rely on somebody else's submission, and nor is there any affirmative authority to say that you could.
But well, that's what I was wondering about, because that's why I sort of stopped and paused, and I mean, it's not as if I've actually turned my mind to this issue, but is it sufficient that somebody else made a submission and you can rely on it?
The position for the minister is different for the reasons that my friend gave yesterday.
Because
so put that to one side.
Section
274B,
I think. 2B or something?
Yes.
They can do whatever they like.
That's what it appears.
That's right.
Right. But can ORUG then pursue a case relying on the relief sought by, let's say, LandPro?
Or WISE.
Or WISE responsible.
Yes. WISE not to some
or whoever.
Yeah,
I could find no authority answering that question.
Proposition.
And where I got to in the end was thinking about the duties of independent planning witnesses before the court. And my view was that they shouldn't be constrained on assisting the court within areas of their expertise, and they shouldn't be so limited to the relief sought by their own, or the party that had engaged them.
Mm.
Now that doesn't fully answer the question. That simply means that the independent experts can provide evidence on the full range of matters, but whether
that
ORUG could pursue
relief.
The relief, I couldn't find any authority to say they could, but in terms of how I've understood this to play out in the past, once the scope, sort of the bookends of scope are before the court and parties can work within those bookends, but whatever it is they're seeking needs to fit. The risk that is run of a party is relying on an underlying submitter is if that underlying submitter withdraws their submission, but the submissions are still before the court. So my submission would be that ORUG could pursue that the relief sought by another party as that is the scope before the court. I couldn't find a reason or a case that said that wasn't the outcome. Perhaps the only additional point I'd note is that the mechanism of the Act through the further submission process might be seen as the machinery to clearly signal or to enlarge the matters originally submitted on. And so if a further submission and support hadn't been lodged, it could be argued, well, that's then the end of the matter, it couldn't be pursued. But again, I could see no authority either way on the point.
Okay.
So I can't answer the question, but that was as far as the research took us.
Okay.
Right, Hydro. 152, the Council has carefully considered the relief sought by Trustpower in relation to hydroelectricity generation. The Court has only heard detailed evidence from Trustpower in respect of its scheme. Whilst there was some limited evidence given by Ms Perkins with respect to the Earnslaw hydroelectricity scheme, Ms Perkins confirmed that she did not provide any relief in her evidence with respect to that scheme. Now, I've gone back and read the transcript when that evidence was given to see whether any further information could be distilled, but that from an evidential perspective is as far as matters were recorded. So the Council's position is that some limited exceptions should be made for those Trustpower schemes identified in the schedule. For those activities authorised by a deemed permit, the Council would support a restricted discretionary activity pathway, providing these limited applications with a consent duration up to 31 May 2035, where the volume and rate taken is in accordance with the historical use and the effects of on the environment arising from the activity are considered. Now, there's been an adjustment made to that paragraph from yesterday's rendition of it because we had the six-year period in there originally, but following the discussions yesterday, the complexities of assessing effects beyond the six-year period only, the position is that the effects of the activity for the longer term in its entirety should be assessed.
To 35 or 38, as they
I'll
want?
Come to that, 35.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where applications are sought for new water in respect of Waipori or Deep Stream, insofar as they're identified in the schedule, then they would be considered under the rules in chapters 6, 12 and 20 of the operative plan. So again, the new is considered still under the operative plan, but with the overlay of the policy on duration. However, access to a longer consent duration up to 31 May 2035 is available provided that the application includes an assessment of any environmental effects. The Council has carefully considered whether the consent duration available for new water for the Waipori and Deep Stream HEPs should extend to 31 May 2038 to align with the existing consents for that scheme. However, on balance and for the reasons set out in Mr. De Pelsmaker's reply evidence, it prefers the slightly earlier date. Further, whilst Ngārūnanga have made it clear that they do not consider any exceptions or exemptions should be made, in legal submissions, Council for Ngārūnanga submitted that it is entirely necessary for the consents granted under the PC7 provisions to be considered within the life of the new regional planning framework. The earlier expiry date proposed by Mr. De Pelsmaker fits within this window, noting the 10-year life of a regional plan. Now, I'm not intending to detract from the submission made by Ngā Runanga that no extension should be appropriate, but that was one of the reasons given, and hence the slightly earlier date. All other hydroelectricity generating activities, both the replacement of existing and new, would be subject to policies 10A22 and 10A23, requiring short-term six-year consent durations. In respect of determination of historical use, the new restricted discretionary pathway agreed to by the experts following expert conferencing enables hydroelectricity generation activities to determine historical use using synthetic and other records. It is proposed that step four of the schedule will not apply to the hydroelectricity generation activities. Step four is intended to remove atypical data. However, atypical data is of importance to hydroelectricity generation activities, as a single peak rate of take might best reflect actual use. For completeness, it is submitted that the accommodation now being supported would give effect to the requirements in the NPSREG, as set out in the opening submissions of Council. That accommodation would also appropriately take into account the benefits that hydroelectricity generation provides with respect to New Zealand's response to climate change. And I have in mind their policy for the NPSFM, together with the provisions within the NPSREG itself, in terms of the contribution that renewables make.
Your operative, I think it is, RPS.
RPS, which also has objective and policies or provisions. For these reasons, it's submitted that the court does not need to determine issues relating to the preamble of the NPSREG and whether the NPSREG applies to the allocation of water and whether renewable electricity generation is a second or third order priority under the NPSFM. The key reasons I say that to be the case is that with respect to the NPSREG, a limited accommodation for trust power schemes would give effect to the policy direction in that document without relying on the preamble. And with respect to the NPSFM 2020, irrespective of whether the activity is a second or third order priority, the first priority under the hierarchy of obligations needs to be addressed first. Any potential effects on the relevant water bodies themselves will need to be assessed if any such application is to be granted consent for a term of more than 6 years.
Okay, and the provisions that you handed out yesterday for hydro are the provisions that you would support?
There are drafting challenges with those provisions as well, and I acknowledge those.
So what's happening there?
So as far as I can take the submission, it is simply that the council supports the accommodation. In terms of the actual provisions, the council hasn't provided further further drafting on that issue.
Okay, so you support the accommodation of trust power. In terms of the actual provisions, there may be difficulties with the provisions handed up on the 6th and the 7th.
Yes, and that would extend also to the provisions handed up by Mr. Welsh, on which the version handed up yesterday was largely based, albeit more restrictive.
Right. Okay. And just remind me, what was the specific difficulty? So much stuff surging around in this case.
There was some further drafting, you may recall, with the policies to make sure that the drop-down or the cross-referencing in policy 10A23 was picked up. So Mr. De Pelsmaker, when asked questions, remember we were tracking in some modifications. In terms, perhaps the... perhaps the question of how the effects get assessed in relation to an existing activity for which longer-term consent is sought fall to be assessed through the lens of the policies and perhaps the objective. There may be a lack of clarity around that.
So is this existing activity effects assessment... there's a lack of clarity around that.
Yes. And that's for existing. The new applications, of course, fall to be assessed, I understand, as discretionary activities under the operative plan. And so that same issue doesn't present with respect to the two new examples or new situations. But there could be a policy gap for considering a longer duration for existing. In the absence of policy support for the environmental outcome against which the
assessment. Trustpower, yeah, new applications, effects assessments under the operative plan, and then call Mr. Walsh was doing something about that. He had an edit. But for existing activities, how do you assess effects? You're saying that the provisions are supported by regional council. There's a lack of clarity around that.
Yes.
And there's a lack of clarity I recall that in relation to the restricted discretionary activity. Oh, no, that's wrong.
Particularly
if.
Right, I'd like to check the transcript. Okay. So this is for... Trustpower wants longer consents to 2038, and that's fine, except, well, how do you assess the effects? And there's no resolution of that. Yep. Trustpower had a suggestion?
Trustpower's suggestion, from recollection, didn't answer the policy question in terms of the acceptability
of those effects. And is that, again, one of the things that Ms. Stiles was seeking to achieve with her edit to the objective, which is looking at the additive effects from a baseline?
Yes,
could have been that.
It could have been that, but there were and are in my submission significant problems with that in terms of who else or which other activities might rely on that concept of additive effects, and it takes off the table the effects of an existing activity. Given the additive nature, it seemed to be only be looking at effects beyond that already occurring in the environment, which goes counter to the Ngāti Rangi approach.
Yeah, which is why I thought it was a Ngāti Rangi fix, but that was denied.
And I'm just thinking about where the home for the effects outcome might properly rest. And I was going to submit that the policy might be the logical place if the policy is going to accommodate these longer durations. The risk, of course, is that PC7 then starts to become the thing it was never supposed to be, which is an environmental plan change.
Yep.
And that's the drafting conundrum with respect both to CWS and, in this context, hydro.
Unless you were to make hydro an exception to Ngāti Rangi.
Yes. Yes, so in that wording, in my submission, would be better reflected in the policy than the objective. I foresee some danger in the objective, whereas if the policy is strictly speaking to hydro, it could and should only ever be read as an exception providing to hydro.
So a limited exception to hydro. Not all hydro.
It's not all, yes, that is important and correct.
So anyway, food the thought, a limited exception for hydro to the effect of the Ngāti Rangi decision, but if it is made, it's to be made in the policy. You are also saying the council would accept in principle new permits on it, subject to, again, a limited exception, it's whatever's written in the schedule. Those permits would have to be assessed under the OP, the operative regional plan.
Yes.
Okay. Alrighty.
So we turn next to the discretionary activity rule being pursued by ORUG and LandPro. So in supplementary evidence, experts for ORUG and LandPro proposed a new consenting pathway incorporating a new objective, amended policy 10023 and a new discretionary activity rule, which was intended to allow the consideration of an application for consent duration of up to 20 years. It is noted that Ms Perkins amended her view to recommend a 15-year duration at the hearing, with no ability for consents longer than 15 years to be granted. However, the Council's position remains that there are a number of significant issues with this proposed consenting pathway. These are summarised by Mr De Pelsmaker in his evidence in reply, but include the grant of consents for a 20-year term would preclude their reconsideration within the lifespan of a new land and water plan, contrary to PC7's intent to facilitate a transition towards a new freshwater planning regime, and could compromise achievement of the environmental outcomes set in the new land and water plan. The Council considers that review conditions are not an effective or efficient means of implementing the changes that will be introduced as part of the new plan. It appears the 20-year timeline is not firm, with Ms Dicey suggesting that it should be lined up with any timeframes included in the new RPS. However, any rule in this process is likely to be operative before the proposed RPS, with the proposed RPS not given significant weight when assessing resource consents at this early stage. A 20-year consent duration is also an extension beyond what is happening at a national level, where 10 to 15 years is a more traditional duration.
Traditional?
Oh, that's a strange word there. more common would be.
Common.
Traditional. Where a long-term consent is granted with a review condition, and the review is discretionary rather than mandatory, it is the environment that bears the risk of the outcome of the review, if a review even takes place, given the difference that will exist between the new plan limits and what is codified in the permits. The risks associated with the activities that would be consented under a longer-term consent pathway are the very risks that the new plan is going to be considering, so it is appropriate to allow the plan to come into being and set out the allocation framework so that all activities are consented under the same set of rules. The suggested discretionary pathway objective essentially excludes consideration of cultural values, although the discretionary activity status allows consideration of a wide range of effects. Putting in place a flow regime for the next 15 years would push out the consideration of cultural values and Te Mana o Te Wai for at least 15 years. And the discretionary rule proposed could have unintended consequences by allowing consent holders to increase their irrigable area and claim that that is substantial investment requiring to be had regard to when reconsenting. It's also noted that it was considered by Ms Perkins that the wording put forward for the proposed discretionary rule is flawed as it does not effectively limit the persons who could use that consenting pathway. Now, in relation to those two pathways, I also rely on the cross-examination of both Ms Dicey and Ms Perkins, where the drafting and the detail of the drafting was explored. The next issue is the submission of Ms Scott on behalf of ORUG in relation to an alternative concept of phasing in expiry dates of resource consents on a catchment, subcatchment or FMU basis. This concept was raised to address her concerns about the practicality of reconsenting water permits if they all expire on the same date. And Ms Scott is concerned that the council, applicant and planning consultants do not have the resources to address this volume of consenting work and the associated complexity that comes with a new planning framework. The court questioned whether any further thinking had occurred in respect of the timing and sequencing for catchments or subcatchments in relation to the phasing of expiry dates. Ms Scott advised that she had not given further consideration as to the details for the timing or sequencing for a catchment or subcatchment phasing approach. Additionally, the court questioned whether the issue of scope had been considered in relation to a phasing approach. Ms Scott advised that this issue had not been discussed. Conceptually, Council considers that a phasing approach of expiry dates for resource consents has merit. However, no evidence has been adduced to support such an approach in relation to the timing or sequencing of expiry dates for catchments, subcatchments or FMUs, and the proposed RPS provides no clear guidance on this matter. And so, whilst conceptually I can see where it was coming from, and it seemed to have some merit, we just don't have the evidence before us to deal with that.
Okay.
On to damming. Council for ORC, ORUG and Falls Dam Company Limited identified a number of issues for the court's determination in respect of large dams in a joint memorandum. The first question of which was, are reservoirs created by the exercise of damming permits a water body for the purpose of Objective 2.1 of the NPSFM? And I agree with my friend on that point, and that, yes, they are water bodies, so I don't propose to take you through the reasoning.
All right, that's fine.
The next question was, should deemed permits to dam and discharge water be excluded from the operation of Plan Change 7? Council for ORUG has suggested that dams should be excluded from the provisions of PC7 as they are of a fundamentally different nature to permits to take water and have different effects. Subject to Objective 2.1 of the NPSFM in any event, and the complexity of the reconsenting of dams and what forms part of the existing environment. Mr. De Pelsmaker set out in detail the merits in a planning sense for including dams in PC7. The Council's position is that in imposing a six-year term on new damming permits to replace deemed permits will allow for the damming to be considered under the new plan and the new RPS, which will provide a more holistic consideration of the affected catchments and give effect to Te Mana Otawai. This includes the ability to consider the interconnected effects of damming activities, discharges and water takes, which it is submitted as consistent with the principle underpinning the NPSFM of Kiu Te Kitai. While Council for ORUG has raised concerns regarding the assessment of on reconsenting in terms of what constitutes the existing environment, it is submitted that there is some discretion on being able to consider the existence of the dam as part of the Ngāti Rangi approach, as it is qualified by the phrase, unless it would be fanciful or unrealistic to assess the existing environment as though the structures authorised by the consent being renewed did not exist. Further, on ORUG's own evidence, it is submitted that there are no imminent dam safety issues that necessitate longer-term consents. Rather, there are separate legal obligations imposed on dam owners and operators through other legislation, including, for example, the Building Act. The Council does not propose any further amendments in respect of dams. The next matter to consider is the presumptive flow standards pursued by Fish and Game. The evidence on behalf of Fish and Game recommended that presumptive flow standards should replace the wording of no more than minor cumulative effects on the ecology and hydrology of the surface water body, as had been set out in Policy 10A23 of the notified version. The purpose of these standards has been stated as applicable for signposting what is likely to constitute a more than minor adverse effect on the ecological health of a water body. The Council's position is that the standards in the table are ambiguous and uncertain for plan users. Dr. Hayes accepted that there is a need for clarity when it comes to implementation of the plan provisions if these thresholds are intended to be read as limits, and as drafted, they do not currently provide that certainty. The Council considers the table would be inappropriate to include in Plan Change 7 for the following reasons. The figures in the table rely on the seven-day MALF being capable of being calculated in all of the circumstances where the table might be applied, other than for intermittent streams. Dr. Hayes accepted that the practicalities of this approach would be a considerable challenge, and that it is simply not possible to estimate MALF in all locations in Otago. It does not identify whether the table is in relation to cumulative allocation rate or block. It does not identify whether total allocation is from a tributary or all water bodies in a catchment, which would be required to be incorporated into a regional plan. While the table has been proposed as a proxy for more than minor effects, it is only dealing with a subset of the potential adverse effects that might occur in relation to the take of water, and significant care would need to be taken when allocating in accordance with the thresholds, not to preclude natural and development values attributed to a water body by Māori and the wider community. There is a risk that the way in which the policy only focuses on ecological assessment, that may result in other values, for example, cultural, amenity and recreational, not being appropriately considered. I just want to pause on that point. As I listened to my friend's submissions on Monday, the language that she was using was all about no more than minor effects, and it did, in my submission, miss the point that it was only a subset of the effects being considered. It's only ecological and it only focuses on the ecological and not other values. And I did put to the witnesses that those flows do not take into account those other effects, which they all accepted. And the risk that exists here is that these ecological thresholds might become or be seen as the standard at which all adverse effects are considered to be less than minor, which is only painting part of the picture when it comes to setting in place flow and allocation regimes. And so my final point is that the thresholds recommended should not be seen as the thresholds that represent the acceptable or appropriate level of allocation for the abstraction of water into the future in Otago.
And that was the problem. Well, I thought that was the problem with the notified version of the third policy. You had two self-selecting values, ecology and hydrology, and it was, what about the rest?
And that, I accept, was the case, and I explored that with the witnesses, particularly the fish and game witnesses, about those values only being a subset. And that's recognised within the document that was being relied on, which was the draft proposed, or the draft NES standards for ecological flow, as not necessarily being appropriate or reflective of cultural or amenity or recreational values.
Okay.
And so for those reasons, the Council opposes the inclusion, either as a policy or as a method, of this aspect of the relief sought by Fish and Game. But I would say that I acknowledge and understand why the relief was being pursued in light of the notified version of Plan Change 7, and it was, in a sense, an effort to address some of the challenges with that drafting. It's just in my submission, the cure could be, I was going to say, more fatal than the cause, but that's not quite the right expression.
Okay.
All right. The next issue that I touch on, determination of historical use. I'm not planning to take the court through this because this is simply picking up on the changes that have been recommended to the schedule. My only submission would be that it's excellent that I don't have to make more lengthy submissions on which version of the method the court should be preferring. The experts have done a good job.
They have.
In that regard. So on to stranded assets next at paragraph 183. As notified, PC7 restricted the size of the area that can be irrigated under a new consent to take and use water to the maximum size of the area that was irrigated in the 2017 to 2018 irrigation season. The intent of the restriction was to reduce the risk of further environmental degradation and reduce financial risk for water users in the absence of certainty around water availability by discouraging further investment in irrigation infrastructure. Amendments have been recommended to expand the date range to 1 September 2017 to 18 March 2020 for determining the maximum area under irrigation. This will capture any expansion in irrigation area that has occurred after the 2017-18 irrigation season, but before PC7 was notified. The amendment has been met with support by a number of submitters giving evidence through the Cromwell weeks in particular of the hearing. Ms Dicey had expressed concerns that farmers would find it difficult to provide proof of and identify what land was being irrigated during a particular period of time. Council asked all farming witnesses whether they would be able to identify on a map of their farm where they have been irrigating, particularly between the period 1 September 2017 to 18 March 2020, and each witness confirmed that they would be able to do this. Concerns have also been raised by submitters that the restriction on the irrigation area does not provide for any investment in planned irrigation expansion that has occurred, but where the expansion has not been realised. This has been referred to during the hearing as being an issue of stranded assets. Mr. De Pelsmaker initially recommended a restricted discretionary activity pathway to address this issue, but withdrew support for this following questioning from the court and council, and I've acknowledged the reasons why he at that stage withdrew support. The council has had the benefit of now hearing from individuals whose investment was affected by the notified version of Plan Change 7. The expansion and date range to 1 September 2017 to 18 March 2020 has addressed the concerns of a number of people who might have otherwise been captured. And evidence presented to the court by, it should be Dr. Taverin, Mr. Paulin and Mr. Webb, we have heard that there are horticultural and viticultural businesses that have invested in irrigation expansion prior to 18 March 2020 but have not fully utilised the expansion. The planners have sought to address this issue of stranded assets through expert conferencing and have recommended a new restricted discretionary activity pathway that may be utilised in the situations I've set out at paragraph 188. The key outstanding issues for the court with respect to stranded assets are, in my submission, what is the appropriate activity status, and second, should the alternative pathway apply to horticulture and viticulture only, or pastoral land uses as well. The Council supports the position reached in the 9th JWS. In particular, it supports the restricted discretionary activity status and limiting the alternative RDA pathway to horticulture and viticulture only, for the reasons set out in the JWS and Mr. De Pelsmaker's evidence. Evidence presented to the hearing showed that where modelling had been undertaken, each of the scenarios modelled showed an increase in nitrogen loss compared to dryland farming system. And that was Dr. Crystal's evidence from recollection. Therefore, the effects of irrigation of pasture, particularly in respect of nitrogen loss, are greater than viticulture or orchards, and as such, the Council considers the stranded assets pathway would not be appropriate for these activities. Whilst Mr. Reid made the submission that the proposed amendment would not resolve the stranded assets issue for Strathclyde, MacArthur Ridge and Mount Dunstan, because his client is a small shareholder in the much bigger Manahita Kia scheme, and the scheme may be reluctant to go down that pathway, it is not clear whether the Manahita Kia scheme would need to go down the RDA pathway in any event due to the existence of hydroelectricity generation within the scheme, or gaps in data, or needing to use other methods to determine historical use. Further, it is not clear how many other irrigators are at risk of having stranded assets and what the nature of their operations are.
Yeah, I don't really understand that last submission. I understand Mr. Reid's concern was that the Manahita Kia scheme might have a choice whether to go down a controlled pathway and not make provision for an increased area on his client's land, and that's simply because if they were going down a controlled pathway, they'd get their consent. Or they could seek to go down an RDA pathway for some small concession in relation to him. It would seem unlikely if there was some uncertainty as what, you know, perhaps unlikely if there's some uncertainty. So you're saying he's wrong, they would not need to go down an RDA?
No, I'm saying that the Manahita Kia scheme might have to go down the RDA pathway anyway.
Because it's got a...
it's got a hydro pioneer.
Yep.
No, I'm shaking of the head.
No?
There's a hydro as well.
May I?
Sure.
Yeah.
The pioneer, well, I suppose if you took the whole catchment, then the pioneer generation is an adjunct to false dam.
Yeah.
If it's the Manahita Kia Irrigation Co-op, which MacArthur Ridge get their water supply from, I don't believe the Manahita Kia Co-op scheme has a hydro component. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the hydro wouldn't apply to that particular scheme, but to the catchment as a whole if they were to progress as one consent, which seems unlikely under controlled pathway. Mm.
Yep, so that's hydro. And what was the other reason? All gaps in data. You're thinking it's improbable.
With that many parties, that there wouldn't be somebody else who may need to take advantage of the RDA pathway.
Now, in terms of how this works, and here I'm, you know, there may be an evidence, and if it's not, we'll have to search for something. If you are a scheme and you apply to take water, do you also apply to use that water, so it's take and use? Or is it the use is effectively the supply to a bunch of other entities hanging off you, just say for argument's sake, farmers. So you take and supply to farmers. Is that how this works?
I had understood it was both the take and use. The use was the end use, if I can use that phrase, not
so it's
just
the
supply.
Oh, okay. And so farmers aren't required to also have their own.
They're not required to get a separate use permit.
Yeah, okay. Mrs. Irving, is your understanding any different?
Short answer is no. I think the permits that I've seen other schemes, it would be for the take and use for irrigation.
Okay, so then the irrigation is actually in there.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of Luggett being an example where there was a scheme, but the use doesn't kind of get into any more fine-grained area than that. And then in those consents, the consents have had essentially a command area map attached to them, identifying the area of land that would be irrigated with that permit.
And the farmer who is the beneficiary of the scheme's water, does he or she have to also have consent?
Not a take and use consent, no.
What sort of consent, if they had any?
Effectively none, unless they breached any of the rules around discharge and so on.
So, which is a different story altogether.
Yes, yeah.
So is that different from Canterbury? Canterbury schemes have use hanging, irrigation scheme takes the water for the purposes of supply. Farmers have their own consents in terms of using that water.
It depends on where in the region, but for the most part, the schemes either hold a take and use for irrigation, and then the land use, the farming land use, is a permitted activity if water's taken from an irrigation scheme. So it's the scheme that's holding the more comprehensive consent.
So it's take and use, yeah.
Yes.
And it too is also looking at the command area and the assortment of activities.
Yes, so the theory of the structure was that the schemes would be the ones responsible for managing the effects and reporting on the effects of the use of that water for whatever use it was being put, rather than having individual farmers having the full suite of consents and each individually having to report.
That might change with the land and water plan?
The situation here, I mean, at the moment there's no requirement for a land use consent for farming activity at all.
No.
And there are multiple ways you can draft that, depending on whether you're regulating the discharge or permitting the discharge if a land use consent's required or held. But certainly from an integrated management perspective, it will be something that'll need to be considered. And again, schemes may then start transitioning into the place of also holding global consents in terms of managing discharges within catchment areas, such that individual farmers don't need to take them. Or so it may be that the scheme say, no, that's your responsibility, individual.
You sort it. No, that's fair enough. And so so with that in mind, is that the key difference between a irrigation scheme, if you like, and a council permit to take and supply? So the council permit to take and supply, at the moment they're saying we're agnostic to how you use it.
whereas irrigation schemes have,
yeah,
at least in my experience, been required to assess the effects to which the water is being used. And if I think back to the Central Plains cases that proceeded, I think as far as the Supreme Court, a leave was granted, but it wasn't argued. There, one of the issues was, could you apply for the take and get certainty of supply of water before you had to put in the application for the use, which assessed all of the effects? And the court said, well, yes, you could. And what the court didn't say was that you didn't have to assess the effects of the use. So irrigation schemes typically do assess the effects of the end use.
Sorry, say it again,
irrigation,
in terms of Central Plains.
Oh, Central Plains. Central Plains.
And I'm thinking Meridian has tried the same on the Waitaki, I suspect, in relation to some of its bigger power schemes. Just give us a take.
Yes.
Yeah.
So give us the certainty of the take, and then we'll invest all of the money in figuring out what are the effects of the use.
Yeah.
And we don't want to do that till we know we've got certainty of the take. But implicit in that is that the effects of the uses are going to be considered as part of the use component. It's not that the irrigation schemes are simply saying take in use, but the effects are somebody else's problem.
So I'm probably not quite following the, what you're saying there. But anyway, the irrigation schemes, they do apply for the take in use. They, on a very global way, are looking at the command area, the assortment or arrangement of activities within that command area, and are looking at effects of the same.
Yes. And back to the Canterbury schemes, a number of them have a global tonnage of nitrogen that can be discharged within the scheme area.
Right.
And so that's then requiring the scheme to be managing and reporting the uses to fit well under the global cap.
And presumably the scheme itself would divvy up that nitrogen bundle, if that's what you can call it, to all of
the shareholders.
Their shareholders.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So far as it doesn't happen here, it's because there's no guidance as to what it is that the schemes could be doing in this space.
Yes, and the schemes, I think, have evolved, at least in Canterbury, from water supply companies to water supply and nutrient load managing companies. That
in Canterbury,
in reflection of the planning framework that had shifted forward.
Yeah.
That shift hasn't yet happened in Otago because the plan underpinning it hasn't required, for example, the nutrients to be managed in that type of a way.
But is that how? Is that why, at least one of the reasons why you argue end use? Well, because it's not dissimilar to an irrigation scheme supplying a command area where there needs to be consideration of the end use, the various activities which have taken, farming activities taking place. So why should water schemes be no different if they know to whom they're actually supplying?
Yes, and when you find the time to read the submissions on the end use, I do draw the analogy between irrigation schemes where the use to which the water is put is considered as part of those applications. I don't see any reason to strike a difference in terms of community schemes.
Mm. All right, well, that's helpful.
So we were on the stranded assets and whether it should be a controlled activity or not to deal with Mr. Reed's clients, and I do understand where he's coming from there. The other thought or thoughts that I had were ones around bundling and whether you could unbundle the Dunstan Creek component of the scheme application, such that it was just that part that was considered as a restricted discretionary activity and other parts.
But then that really is for the Munhead scheme
to
drive,
determine.
And I guess how much influence Mr. Reed has in relation to that scheme.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which brings me on to the second point as to whether those companies could actually pursue their own permit.
Those what? The...
They could pursue renewal of their own part of the permit.
I think what you've just said is that in Otago, farmers who take water from the scheme don't obtain resources.
There are, and my friends will know more than me about this, but from what I've seen, there are a range of different circumstances where some permit holders had transferred their underlying deemed permits to the scheme, or they've authorised the scheme to use and distribute their rights under a deemed permit. Now, I don't know what the situation is with Mr Reed's clients in terms of whether there was an underlying permit. There may have been one permit that was in the name of MacArthur Ridge, but an additional water was taken from the scheme. So,
I see. Transfer their permit to the scheme, and the scheme,
then it essentially exercises it globally with the other.
Well, that might be a sweetener for the scheme, but you're only suggesting that insofar as that's a sweetener for the scheme might go RDA route.
Yes, or they might say, well, we'll finish our contractual arrangements, rely on our underlying permit and renew it. But it will depend on the existence of an underlying permit, and we don't have evidence before us about that.
No.
So
the only other thing that's been troubling us as well, if the issue, I'd speak for myself, was troubled by main lines being installed, which would, as Dr. Davron said, be used for, could then be subsequently rolled out for centre pivots, which then picks up the activities, farming activities, more likely to result in contaminants than, say, viticulture and horticulture.
Yes.
So it was that part that I was particularly concerned about.
Yes.
Here we've only got viticulture and horticulture, so in terms of your RDA, matters of discretion. If you don't like what is proposed, you're not going to turn it down. You're just going to say do better in terms of your nutrients, aren't you?
You just impose some conditions to that effect.
So if you're not going to turn them down, you're just going to impose tighter conditions, why isn't it controlled? Yeah, that's what, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I probably can just pull up some of those good guidance documents and have certain and enforceable conditions.
Yes.
What else are you going to achieve in terms of your matter of discretion?
It, whether it clutters up the controlled activity rule or not, I'm not sure. I think there would be an extra component to it, and the matters of discretion would need to come down and be done. I mean,
that's a drafting.
I don't foresee
issue.
A drafting difficulty with
so
that.
I think that's where. Yeah, we're thinking about it. We thought, you're not going to turn them down. So in that case, you know, you perhaps ought to be thinking about a lesser restriction, impose the same control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, in reality, the council position has been informed by the joint witness statement. So it's. I mean, I understand where the court's coming from on that.
Yeah.
And I understand the issue that Mr. Reed's clients have.
Question whether an RD might be more appropriate.
We did, but that
perhaps
was
it was wider.
It's centre pivot.
It was, yes.
Taking it into dairy.
But given it's more limited
now.
Yeah.
You brought it back now to viticulture, and the same concern does not arise. It's not to say there's no contaminants. There will be, but it's not unlikely that you're looking for a turn down. All right, so anyway. You don't see any great difficulties if the court were minded to go that way?
No.
No. Okay, just a drafting exercise? Okay. Alrighty.
Section 128. We're getting close.
That's good, because I've got to leave at 3, I'm just saying.
Thank you.
Is that right? 3? Yep, 3.
It has been submitted at various stages throughout this hearing that a review clause on a longer-term consent would be a suitable or even preferable alternative to a short-term consent. The Council's position remains that review conditions are not sufficient, as they do not allow for the cancellation of a consent, and in any event, they are likely to be ineffective in addressing a substantial overallocation when it comes to implementing the NPSFM. As such, the Council's position is that a consequence of a review may be to change the flow and allocation regime in such a way that it impacts upon the reliability of any grant of water to an individual farmer, and therefore there is no benefit of increased certainty in respect of a review condition rather than a short-term consent. Consent reviews have not been tested in heavily allocated catchments. There is a difference between conditions that may be able to be imposed on a review compared to reconsenting. While Section 128.1b of the RMA would allow Council to review consents to implement new minimum flows, a minimum flow is a temporary restriction, whereas a change in allocation is an ongoing limitation. Resource consent reviews, particularly on a region-wide basis, are a challenge for the Council, and resource intensive, so it is unlikely the Council will be able to review all consents as soon as the new plan is made operative. Therefore, the environment bears the risk in terms of the time it might take to put in place an MPSFM compliant flow regime. And a short-term consent is more likely to be effective in terms of achieving the outcomes for a new plan than a review condition, because a review condition does not allow cancellation, which may need to happen in some cases as a result of the MPSFM framework. Councillor Orugg has contended that the Section 131(1)(a) viability consideration on a consent review also carries with the test of have regard to, that's not the right word there. Make grammatical sense, which is the same standard required as for the value of the investment under Section 104(2)(a). Councillor Orugg contends that this is therefore neutral to the risk of acting or not acting. However, in the Council's submission, weight must be given to the fact that case law is clear that on a consent review, the review or any new conditions imposed as a result cannot prevent the activity for which consent has been granted. To the contrary, under Section 104, while the existing investment must be had regard to, the option to decline the consent, if required in the circumstances, remains available. In the Council's submission, it is more appropriate to allow full consideration of the activity once the new plan is operative, rather than being restricted to the starting point of having to ensure that the conditions do not prevent the activity. And I would perhaps interpolate there, as this issue was tested with witnesses throughout the hearing, the issue of economic viability was considered to be unique to each and every one, depending on the underlying circumstances. And that perhaps highlights some of the very real challenges with embarking upon a consent review, because the outcome is going to be necessarily informed by the individual position of a consent holder, as opposed to what is the state of the environment.
Mm.
In addition, Councillor Orugg submits that Section 128 is equipped to deal with any issues of allocation created by the new plan. However, a Section 128 review can only consider allocation for the purposes of determining how much water is able to be allocated above a limit, rather than allocating water to other classes of abstractive use. This would amount to reallocation of water between uses, and that, I submit, is the function of a regional plan rather than a consent review process. And that was the point I was making earlier on in the submissions about different classes of use. Now, next I turn to the uncertainty of short-term consent durations. It's been submitted during the hearing by a number of parties that short-term consent durations create uncertainty around the long-term availability of water, or uncertainty on the condition on water abstraction and use that may be imposed after 2025. The Council's position is that it is in fact the new Land and Water Plan to be notified, the MPS 2020 and the RMA reform that is creating this uncertainty, not short-term consent durations under PC7. During the hearing, a number of witnesses acknowledged that it was this future planning framework to some extent that was creating the uncertainty. Additionally, the Council has signalled through PC7 that further investment in infrastructure should be discouraged given this uncertainty in the future planning framework. This is because under the future planning framework, water allocation is uncertain. A number of witnesses acknowledged the signal in PC7, or that the signal PC7 is sending, and in some cases acknowledged that it was better to be aware of the uncertainty under the future planning framework for water allocation now, rather than invest in new infrastructure and to find out later that water might not be available. Paragraph 200, we get to section 124. Council has presented legal submissions on the application of section 124 and in response to the submissions from Dr. Somerville. Council does not seek that the court makes a finding on section 124 as it relates to deemed permits if the court does not consider it needs to. In my submission, it is not necessary for the court to make a finding on the application of section 124. What is relevant for the purposes of PC7 is what is the most appropriate solution to respond to the expiry of deemed permits. It is submitted that the application of section 124 is not relevant to the court's determination on the proposed solution set out above. Now, the last part of the submissions, I'm hoping might be able to be taken as read until we get to the end. And I'm just stepping through how the Act controls timeframes for processing consents.
You want us to read it to ourselves, and I think
you could.
I suppose to the extent that you make a point is that the applicants will need to amend their applications, which is perhaps the point that Ms King hadn't contemplated when she had filed her brief. There would need to be substantial changes if you wanted to avail yourself of a controlled or even an RD pathway.
Yes, the purpose of putting these, the underlying mischief I was seeking to address in the submissions was that applicants couldn't simply lodge an application and then sit on their hands and rely on Section 124. The timeframes in the Act.
Oh, right, sitting on their 124.
Yes.
They do around the country.
Which is why the timeframes have progressively been tightened and tightened in successive iterations of the Act, I suspect. And the timeframes are, as I step through, they are far more directive than they once were. In the good old days, you put an application and said, please place it on hold, and 4 years later, you'd dust it off.
So you're saying to the extent that the region hasn't processed any application, it is within the those decisions not to process any application thus far that is intravirous the Act?
I would hope so. I haven't analysed them.
Not but not us. Don't ask that question. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, but
the decision about taking them off hold and doing something with them, is that something the council has totally under its control? Which so things can't just sit around?
Yes is my answer to your question. The way these timeframes now operate, very difficult to put on hold an application at an applicant's request for an indefinite period. Timeframes need to be specified when responding to Section 92 requests.
Yes, but we have a whole lot on hold at the moment, so what unlocks the hold?
The question of how they are on hold is one that this court perhaps needn't trouble itself with.
That's what I said. He hasn't asked the question, sort of plausible denial, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, but if you think about the other end of the equation, can applicants control how long they remain on hold? My submission is no, the Act has machinery within it to avoid that outcome occurring.
Which...
So we're relying on the council to do the right thing.
And absolutely.
The right and proper thing.
Yeah, and there was a question by me about the indefinite hold.
Yes,
yeah.
that was the question that I was seeking to answer.
Because if you're on an indefinite hold and you are presuming that you have a 124 right, then you can continue to increase in the irrigation area and expand the take.
Correct. There are risks there.
And that's the mischief of an indefinite hold.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I then come to my concluding paragraph, and that is a response to the prayer for relief, which my friend for ORUG concluded his submission with. And this is an important point. The council is extremely conscious of the impact that imposing six-year permits will have on communities throughout Otago. It was clear to me from listening to the evidence that the concerns were very real and the challenges particularly confronting, particularly for the rural community. The council's approach with respect to PC7 is that it is better for water users to know now that there may be insufficient water available in the medium to long term to justify significant investment in infrastructure in the short term. Further, the council acknowledges that the rural community has expended significant funds on preparing replacement applications for resource consent. If this court approves PC7, the investment in better understanding the environment from which water is to be taken and used will not be wasted, The information obtained in support of those applications will be equally valuable when informing the content of the new land and water regional plan to come.
Okey-dokey.
So those are my submissions. May it please the court.
Thank you. So, so we've still got an unresolved issue in relation to priorities, which we need to turn our put our thinking caps on in relation to, and unresolved in relation to hydro about the FX issue.
Yes.
And you said mentioned something about yesterday. You said, "Oh, because of some questioning yesterday," and I was thinking, "Oh, heck."
Oh no, that was the, and it was in the context of the TA provisions yesterday, but I thought the same issues potentially arose with respect to the hydro provisions.
Okay.
So just that'll need to be closed out, but it was in terms of the effects that I had in mind.
Yeah, the effects, okay. And then we've got big issues in relation to community water supplies, because we've got your provisions and I think they're problematic, and we've got Nerving's provisions.
Yes.
And then we've got everybody else's relief as well.
I'm in no position and don't pursue the council's drafting on that. And in a sense, it was an 11th hour trying to see if the provisions could be pulled in, but then they were tested and it just doesn't work from a drafting perspective.
But Ms Irving's provisions weren't tested in it. Well,
no,
maybe
they weren't again. There are still challenges.
Yeah, and the challenge is always not so much for new, because you could always go under the operative plan, but for replacements, it's that extended period of time for replacements and how one is managing effects.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Right up. Okay.
And there was a joint witness statement on the schedule to follow, so that'll get squared away.
Good. And then we've got evidence and submissions on
the
RPS.
Proposed RPS. Yes. Yes.
And that worries me only insofar as parties will say, got no question for the other witness, so it accepts it as read. And if there are significant differences as between them, then it's like for the court to discover what that could be and therefore how it might roll out. And I just, really do not like that when that approach is adopted, because the court may well overlook something which is of importance. And and of course parties always have access to those witnesses to chat things through, but we don't, you know. And so I think from time to time we just simply miss some importance or some nuance of something which has been placed before us because we're not talking. Yeah, and we're just having documents handed up, sometimes on the JWSs with little explanation, unsatisfactory explanation.
Yes.
That's frustrating for everybody, but it's frustrating for us to
understand.
Be wasting time because we don't understand something. Okay. All right, anyway, it's an adjournment because we've got that coming. And a big thank you also, because it is actually easier said than done to attempt to do what the region has attempted to do in relation to plan change 7. So it's been a mighty task, and credit region for being prepared to examine its position on the plan change, after the first week. I think full credit to the council for doing that, because whilst that has undoubtedly resulted in yet more work for persons responding to that change of position, insofar as perhaps their first drafting of evidence especially is not actually, maybe redundant in parts. I'm grateful that the council did that. I think it's far easier to work up from a process-only plan and backfill what you need to backfill in than it is a larger plan in this context. So it's a much simpler process in theory.
Yes, and the hearing that played out in those first 2 weeks.
So thank you very much for the cases presented. So we're adjourned. We're adjourned. Thank you.
Your Honour pleases.
All rise.
Yeah, and I haven't gotten further than that. And you know.